My name is Bill Grace, and I'm from the Center for Ethical Leadership in Seattle, Washington, a nonprofit organization in Seattle. And today's session is service and justice. And having just come from Duane's session on the prophets, I'm inspired to really try to emphasize the concept of justice, and to and therefore this session might be a little bit uncomfortable. And if it is, I'll recognize that as having been successful. Okay, so I'd like to take a look, and I'm going to stand up in just a bit here and wander around. It's just my jeans. Not the ones I'm wearing, but the biological ones. I'd like to begin by taking a look at a just approach to service, and to really take a look at the teachings of Paulo Freire, a Brazilian educator who believed that much of the necessary wisdom in our culture was in the lived experience of the poor, and the degree to which we included the poor in ongoing decision making in the community, then we would bring into that equation sort of necessary wisdom to really, first of all, understand what the problem is, and then to begin to understand how could we fix things. During the probably countless discussions on welfare reform that have occurred in the last 18 months in this country, my guess is that 90% of those sessions occurred without any poor in the room. Okay, and I think that we continue to struggle with how to serve justice, but we don't do it effectively because we oftentimes leave the poor outside of the equation and don't see them as important community resources in terms of wisdom. So in Ferrari's notion, let me get to this in just a second, but preface it with two other approaches. A traditional approach in our culture is one of charity. We're going to talk about that more. But charity is really a hierarchical approach to service. It assumes that I'm up here and the people that I'm going to serve are down here, and I kind of come out of my sort of luxurious position in culture and spend a brief moment with them, ladling some soup, handing them a blanket, maybe visiting them briefly in the nursing home because after all it's depressing, and then leaving. And that is probably the most predominant form understanding of service in our culture, and it's elitist and it's ineffective. A more powerful approach is a more egalitarian one, and we're going to be talking about that in a bit, and I believe that it's compassion, and that gets us a little bit closer. But the ultimate form of service is where we do this, is I serve the other in order that I may learn from them. So if I serve you, I serve in order that I may learn from you. So if I am working at a soup kitchen, it's not enough to ladle the soup. Could I develop a relationship with people who come into that soup kitchen over time and get to the point where I really get to know them? I not only get to know their name, but their story, and begin to understand how did they get into this position? How is it that they're on the streets? And as I get to know their story, they give me some incredibly important, necessary wisdom that I need if I would like to understand how to become involved in systemic change that maybe causes a lot of people to be on the streets or to be hungry or to be on welfare. They accept my service so that they can teach me. And what we do at this point is we give the poor their rightful dignity. Someone says that because the poor have suffered, they have the right to be our teachers. And when we serve in this way, we engage in what Ferrari calls the pedagogy of the oppressed. We begin to listen to the poor deeply and believing that they have a great deal to teach us and the rest of the community. By the way, I'm going to present for about 20 to 30 minutes, and then what I'd like to do is stop and engage in what Holden does very well, and that is some good animated discussions. Okay? This is a quote from a person named Peter Hans Kolbenbach, a father general of the Jesuits. That's his title. I always chuckle at that a little bit, but it has everything to do with Ignatian spirituality. Service and the use of power. He says, here's what we need to worry about as we engage in service. The first thing we should recognize is that if we have something to give, that we ought to remember, where does it come from? Whether it's talents, where did that come from? What about resources? Where did that come from ultimately? And he says, if we reflect on that even a little bit, we begin to believe that our gifts are gifts from God. And in service, we are simply asked to share the gifts that we have been given. That's not an extraordinary request. To whom much is given, much will be expected. But at the moment when sharing should take place, there can come the great temptation to hold on to the gift and turn it into a means of accruing personal power. That desire to seek more and more power can become insatiable, thus the seeds of injustice are sown. So the point here is that if we practice service, we really will be rescued from the temptation of hanging onto power and being corrupted by it. So service, in some ways, for those who have much, is a life vest. It'll keep you afloat in a sea that would tempt you to go under and be submerged by things like power and wealth. Well, I liked the Jesuits, and I worked with them for about a half dozen years, but I found them very difficult to understand at times. They're just, you know, sometimes I'm like Winnie the Pooh, a bare little brain, and the Jesuits are, you know, a little bit too deep for me. So this quote from a singing group, the Montana Logging and Ballet Company. And I brought a tape, and unfortunately, we were listening to some music on the way up. And I have the case, and I'll pass that around so you can see these guys. But inside the jacket is the Four Seasons, and I don't think you want to hear them. But this is the Montana Logging and Ballet Company that's coming around. They are from Montana, and they have a song entitled, Somebody Loves Me Like a River. And in this song is this beautiful line that I think distinguishes between power and influence. I'm here in Holden Village these 2 weeks for a number of reasons. One is to get some time away from work. Another is to get some time with my family in a more private setting. I'm here for my own renewal. The village always renews me. But I know that I'm also here because I'd like to have some influence. Okay? I'd like to have some influence over the way in which the church sees things today, sees problems, and I'd like to have some influence over our understanding of what is leadership and what is not. So, but power would mean something different, something that I want to possess and that ultimately possesses me. So take a look at this quote and see if it helps you the way it helps me in distinguishing between power and influence. And if we distinguish between those two, I think we're freer agents of service. First of all, I'm not the spring of the river. And I don't want to be the endless sea. I just like to be the humble riverbank and let the waters flow through me. Depending on what part of the country you're from, if you're from North Dakota or if you're from the Seattle area in this last season, you understand the importance of riverbanks. Okay? Riverbanks are not just passive. They do if the river is not over its flood stage, because we've done things to the land that make the land less capable of absorbing the necessary runoff. But if we are a riverbank in normal conditions, we really do direct the flow of the river. We really do affect the course of the river. But the riverbank is also wise enough to let the water flow on, to let the water flow through me. So with that brief understanding of the difference between power and influence and service rightly understood, let's just take a little bit deeper look at those three types of service. The first one is, as I see it, is service as charity. And the only purpose of it, as hard as this may sound, is the alleviation of our guilt. In Western culture, we have so much more than the rest of the world. And many of us have so much more than the poor of this country that when we write a check to United Way, that when we give out a little bit of money on the street, that even maybe when we make our contribution in church knowing that some of it's going to LWF and maybe the people in Biafra in earlier decades, or the people in Rwanda, will be a little less cold this evening because we've given them a quilt or we've given them a little bit of money to buy some food or buy some grain so that they can plant. I believe charity, service as charity, is ultimately intended for our own good feelings and the alleviation of our guilt. And here is a little image. See if this rings a bell for you. This is my sort of one-man act of meeting a homeless person on the streets of Seattle. Okay, and I'd like you to take a look at what's going on inside my head as I'm approaching this person. There's a homeless person down there against that wall. I'm approaching them, they're approaching me, and they're panhandling, okay? And all of a sudden I'm walking, I'm late for a meeting, by the way, and I go, oh my God, here's a homeless person. What should I do? Should I give them a dollar? If I give them a dollar, they might buy it on alcohol, and I'll just be feeding their habit. But maybe they really do need a dollar for lunch. Maybe I should give it to them. Well, I wish I had time to take them to lunch, but I guess I don't because I'm gonna be late for a meeting. Oh my God, okay, I'll give them something. Oh, I hope there's a one on top. Oh my God, it's a 10. Okay, I'm gonna give it to him because I don't want to look cheap and ruffle through it. Now what am I gonna have for lunch?
Been there, done that.
Who was I focused on during that entire encounter? In my sense is that service as charity is just that. My whole experience with that homeless person was 99% focused on me, and hardly at all focused on the other person, let alone the system that put that person on the street. Okay? And I don't know about in your community, but somewhere between 40 to 50% of the people on the street are Vietnam War veterans, still suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome. Okay? We have still rejected them. We spit on them when they came home from the war, and now we're just asking them to stay on the streets. The focus is self-centered, obviously, and the vision is short-sighted. Even if I gave the person 10 bucks, that's maybe one lunch, one dinner, and one bottle of wine, and cheap wine at that. Okay? And I happen to believe that that is, unfortunately, the majority of our acts as individuals and the majority of acts as institutions, as the church. The next one gets closer. It really is closer. And I think we sometimes give compassion, however, too good a name. I'd like to make a point that it is absolutely the next right step, but that it is not enough. The purpose now is the alleviation of suffering, compassio, to suffer with. That's getting real close. It is the genius of the prophets. It is the power of Jesus to understand the pain of another. Walter Brueggemann writes in his book, Prophetic Imagination, that it is the ability to feel pain, to feel the pain of the other, that empowers the prophet. Also the Spirit of God, but I also need to feel the pain of the other, or else it's difficult to speak on their behalf. And the focus seems to be getting closer. The focus is the poor. Would you please look at the poor and look at their suffering and let's have compassion on them. It sounds right. It sounds great. And all of that is good. But the vision is still short term. And for those of you who just arrived in the village in the last 3 or 4 days, imagine this with me. For those of us who've been here a little longer, it would be too difficult to imagine this. But for those who just arrived, imagine this. That just before you left home, someone left the kitchen sink running. And you saw it running, but you saw one of your family members go past it, and you thought that they had turned the water off. And I don't know about in your house, but sometimes the dish towel, the washcloth that we use to help wash dishes, sometimes we drape it right over the faucet. Do you do that? Well, in this case, your washcloth has fallen into the drain and has been blocking the drain. The whole time you've been in the village. And the person that you thought was going to turn off the water didn't. since you've been here, water has been pouring over the sink. It's now ankle deep in the kitchen. It's going out into the carpets. It's seeping up the wicker furniture. It's terrible. When you get home, and unfortunately, you know, the first bus has left. When you get home, what's going to be the first thing you'll do?
Scream.
After cursing. Say it again.
Turn off the water.
Turn off the water. That makes you a social prophet. Okay? Do you know why? Because day after day, week after week, month after month, in this culture and throughout the world, the church is content to mop the floors. Hungry people continue to flow into our communities in record numbers. There are more homeless people on the streets than ever before. The majority of them now are women and children. Families are losing their family farms in the Midwest, still in record number. And we mop the floors. We build soup kitchens and then we expand them. We build homeless shelters and now we specialize. We have homeless shelters for children. We continue in a short-term effort to warehouse the homeless and to offer a little bit of bread and soup to the hungry. I fear the day, and I used to say it as a joke, but I believe it's going to happen now, and I hope I weep on this day. I hope I have the courage of Dwayne to weep publicly. That some college in this country is going to offer a master's degree in homeless shelter administration. I used to say it as a joke, but I know it's going to happen. And at that point, we will have institutionalized homelessness. Why? Because our vision is short-term, and we're not committed to justice. Service is justice. The purpose is to build the good city. That's what we call it at the Center for Ethical Leadership. It's to work with God in the creation of the kingdom. It's to ensure that another generation of homeless people is far less likely. Because we've begun to become more concerned about systems and institutions. Why is it that 1 in 4 African American men in this country have had a direct encounter with the court system? They've either been to court, been in jail, or on parole. Is it really something wrong with that culture? Or is there something wrong with the system that causes us to systematically mistreat people of color? In 1969, you might think this is an interesting number and it's easy to remember, but it's an unfortunate number. In 1969, the average woman in this country earned 69 cents to every dollar a male earned. Since then, we've tried to pass the Equal Rights Amendment. All of our pronouns have been sensitized. We've been talking about women's issues now for almost 3 decades. And at this point in our culture, women now earn 68 cents to every dollar a male earns. We are afraid to unpack the systems and institutions in this culture that perpetuate poverty and oppression because the truth is it'll cost us something. We shy away from systemic solutions because I'm afraid it's going to increase my mortgage payment. Because I'm afraid it's going to reduce my savings account. Because I'm afraid it's going to reduce the amount of money that I can take home on a monthly basis because maybe there is only so much to go around and that justice requires a redivision of the pie. We live in a limited universe, folks. The pie cannot continue to expand into infinity. We live in a finite system here. When we live at Holden, we get in touch with that. We know that if we let the hot water run too much, that someone will go without. We know that if we don't sort our garbage, that it's going to be a more expensive community to maintain. We don't use energy insensitively because the river is only capable of so much. Holden is a wonderful metaphor for getting in touch with the importance of the redistribution of a limited pie. We're afraid of systemic solutions that would critique institutions because we know in our heart of hearts that it will cost us something. There is a model of leadership that we use at the Center for Ethical Leadership, which I've had the privilege of working on and developing over the last 10 years. And we're pretty excited about it because we think it explains a lot of things. Earlier last week, we asked people to get in touch with their values as a source of courage and a source of wisdom in their lives. What we recommend is that service, especially to those who are dispossessed in some way, is a necessary next step. Because if you can imagine, if you knew what your core values were, and they were as apparent to you as the lines on your left hand, and right adjacent to that, you had a service experience where you fed the hungry, where you helped to house those who were homeless, where you worked with the widow and the orphan. At some point in that service experience, if it came into the context of your core values, my core values are love and family, therefore it is difficult for me to serve the hungry and not see them as a member of my family, and if I am called to love them, then I have to ask the question, why is there hunger in Seattle? And I mentioned this earlier, a Brazilian priest, Dom Helder Kammerer, said that when I fed the hungry, they called me a saint. When I asked why there was hunger, they called me a communist. As we move from values into service, service begins to conjure up a sense of righteous indignation. Because all of a sudden, this person who we've served, if we've gotten to know them in a humble way, by sitting at their feet and letting them teach us, their story touches us, and at some point out of righteous indignation, we begin to say something ought to be different. And we use that word ought, then philosophers say we are in the business of creating a new vision. Because if you think that something ought to be different, you're in the process of creating a vision, but you're also beginning to build a sense of moral obligation to do something about it. We're going to be talking about this process here, moving from service to vision in just a second. But my belief is that we have a lot of grand visions in the church, maybe even in our own homes. And what we need to do is to find a way to move from vision to voice. When I claim my voice, I do like the prophets. I stand in the middle of the square and I say, here I stand, I can do nothing else. Homelessness and hunger have no place in God's kingdom. And until everyone is fed, until everyone is housed, until everyone has health care, until everyone has work that provides them dignity, we can't rest as a church. Our work is not done. And then virtue stands for the common good. So I have to ask myself, how are my values in keeping with the common good so that it does not become a privatized source of morality? How is my vision in keeping with the common good so it doesn't become something skinheads who certainly have a vision for how the country ought to be a different place, but it is not in keeping with the common good. This is sort of the moral litmus test. And how is my voice or my activities, the means by which I move towards the vision, in keeping with the common good? Well, I'm going to stop here in just a second, but just make these points. When we engage in service, it's really only about 1/4 of the job. Service, I believe in God's plan, has the power of transforming us, if we'll let it. And this is what I'd like to recommend to all the churches, is that if you have a feeding program, first of all, good for you. If you're working with a program at your church or in the community somewhere that's housing the homeless, good for you. If you're working with those who are trying to read, good for you. But service without reflection remains charity. When we come back after having served the hungry and spent time with them and got to know their stories because we're willing to humbly sit at their feet, this is what I would love churches to do. I'd like for them to go back to the church and to turn down the lights and to light some candles and to serve a very simple dinner of soup and bread, and to sit around and to ask themselves three questions. They'd get at, what happened to you this evening? How do you see the other differently? And based on this, what do you think we're obligated now to do in order to build a good city? Questions we might ask ourselves is, who are you as a result of this experience? You have a deeper understanding of yourself? Who are you really? Have the poor taught anything about who you are really? Has your experience in service clarified any further the purpose for your life? And to remind ourselves of what are our core values so that we can begin to integrate them into our service experience. When we work with the other, we need to ask ourselves these questions. Who did I meet tonight? Was it John, the homeless person who's been here 15 times, or was it Jesus? What was their story? Did you get to know their story? Do you know how and why that they're on the streets this evening? What did they give you? What did they teach you? But that raises the question of compassion. And at this point in the evening, there's probably a great deal of compassion, maybe some pain and some tears in the room. But our work isn't done until we ask the systemic question of, beyond John's story, beyond Mary's story, is there something systemically wrong? What needs fixing in our community? What's the root of the problem? What would it mean to turn the water off? How are we mopping the floors? Maybe we need to continue to mop the floors because that's a safety hazard, but what would it mean to turn the water off? What can I do? And then finally, in faith and in prayer and in public, what will I do? And if the church were to do that, I believe that the kingdom could come. I love this image of Mandela and de Klerk. If it can happen there, it can happen anywhere. What is the measure of a good city? Is that how safe and well cared for are the most vulnerable? How welcomed are diverse voices and perspectives? And to what degree are values and principles essential to the bottom line? And then moments of celebration, moments of redemption like this, are possible in every town, in every city, in every neighborhood in the world. And let me stop there, because what I'd like to do is to now talk about whatever you'd like to talk about in relation to all of that.
I went on a hike up the Heart Lake, and on the way back, I had a conversation with my daughter-in-law that was very meaningful to me. I was telling her that racism can creep up on you, and I had an experience once of just driving along in the car near my home, and the thought came into my mind with a kind of a, well, it was just suddenly there, and the thought was, you have changed my city. And then I was appalled. I thought, you know, what right do I have to say such a thing? I mean, how is it my city? So I said that. And then Christy said, well, I don't think you have to be so guilty about that. She said, we need to grieve change. And I thought that was a really important insight, that we can get very self-condemnatory. But if that's where we stop, then we only diminish our ability to do something. But if we can take those real feelings of loss, which there are and there must be when things do change, and if we can acknowledge that there is a change that is hard for us to make, then maybe that can enable us to move forward. And so So one of the steps in moving may be to find some means of dealing with the grief that comes in having to change what has been dear to us.
I think that's really honest and powerful. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me.
I've really been wrestling a lot with this whole question. We as a society have, I think our every society seems doomed to have to deal with a particular issue, whether they like it or not, and it's their cross to bear. Like, the Israelis are doomed to have to deal with the Palestinians. There's just no, it goes way back in their history. We as a people are doomed to deal with our idolatry, really, I think, which is freedom. And we have placed freedom as a greater value than compassion as a society. And those have some positives, of course, which we all know about, and have some negatives too. You know, for example, one person's freedom is another person's suffering. Your freedom to own a gun means a danger to other people, oftentimes. There are those who say, you're taxing me to help a third person is, first, an infringement of my freedom. Second of all, it corrupts that person because it places that person in a state of unfree dependency on an institution. Mm-hmm. Robs them of self-respect and so on and so forth. And it also takes away some of the entrepreneurial energy of individuals to maybe come up with creative solutions that the government has to come. Yet I also know that there are obviously great needs that are being unmet. There are great economies of scale of having some kind of infrastructure out there that we can all contribute to make it possible. But, you know, it seems like as a society we've debated and come to a new consensus that the old system was wrong, or the old system wasn't working. Let's try something new. Let's throw out the bathwater and maybe something else gets thrown out with it and see what comes of that. I think we're in this period now. This is a grand experiment of tying, of setting loose a lot of folks who depended on the safety net. Setting them loose and saying, you figure it out. And I've heard stories pro and con about what happens when people are suddenly forced to find a different safety net. They go to their family, they go to their friends, and suddenly, I mean, there are those who would argue that getting rid of this government safety net actually helps promote individual transactions to support one another. Anyway, I just thought I'd throw that out there, that we're...
I want to just pick up on one point that you made. It was this notion of freedom at all costs. And it's... My own perception is that the ultimate symbol that reigns in our culture is the dollar bill. And that any argument from scripture or for the Constitution that supports that is what we raise up, so that we are quick to talk about freedom and rights in this country. Raise your hand if you have seen the Bill of Rights or a facsimile thereof in a book or on a wall. Take a look around. Everybody has. Raise your hand if you've seen the Bill of Responsibilities. The real question in this country is, why didn't we write one? And I think there's a profound answer there. Does anybody want to take a guess why we didn't write one? You have to picture the times. Certainly, Jefferson and others understood that democracy was a balance of rights and responsibilities, that those who lived under the reign of the king or queen would have to take on more responsibility to move from subject to citizen. We would have to take responsibilities. You couldn't move from subject to citizen just by claiming rights. You had to assume responsibilities for the city, because what we're saying is that the king or queen couldn't do it all. We wanted to try a different experiment. Why didn't we write a Bill of Responsibilities? It's a really important question. Anybody want to take a guess? Connie?
Maybe because some people fled religious persecution.
Okay.
And everybody, I think many more people practiced religion when they came. Maybe we didn't do it because people felt that that was taken care of, because people were very faithful to whatever faith they belonged to.
Okay. So, and what else? What were our communities like back 220 years ago?
They were interdependent.
They had to help each other on the frontier. They couldn't survive.
That was Jefferson's argument. He said, as long as there was a frontier, then we would understand our civic responsibilities, because the frontier is unforgiving. And the frontier, rugged individualism did not settle the West. Community did. People traveled in wagon trains. And when somebody's axle broke, someone else lent them an axle because maybe the wagon tongue or the oxen, your oxen were gonna die next week. And you took care of each other while on the Oregon Trail. And that spirit of frontier hardship reminded all of us of the need to care for one another. In my wife's hometown of 500, there are people who are developmentally disabled, there's people who have delayed stress syndrome, there's people who have been injured by farm accident, there's people who are chronically alcoholic or addicted to drugs, and none of them are on the streets. And the truth is because there's a network of relationships that help us to be reminded of our responsibilities to each other. And my greatest hope for that being renewed is the church, and to be that place where we could feel that deeply again.
The only thing that bothers me just a little bit with that argument about my freedom is infringed upon if you as a third person ask me to give taxes that will help a third party, is that we don't ever seem to attack that at the other end of the scale, in the sense that the rich, the corporations, get all kinds of welfare, if I can put it in those terms, and nobody gets excited about it. I get welfare. I have a retirement account. Because I'm in the tax bracket I am, it is a tax-sheltered annuity that I'm not going to have to pay as much tax on, because I can save it till I'm 65 when I'm in a different tax bracket. Poor people can't do that.
Just take a look
at the
savings and loan bailout.
Oh, yeah.
How much money we spent on
or
that.
Or look at, bailing out Chrysler Corporation. Or Boeing going to Olympia and getting preferred tax status for something. I mean, there's all that corporate welfare that doesn't bother us much when it's in the billions of dollars. But if you see a lady getting $500 a month on welfare and she has a steak in her grocery basket, the whole world seems to be falling down, because look what she's doing. She's on welfare. That bothers me.
Because I tend to talk too long, I usually keep a little stopwatch near me to remind me of the time. So would someone remind me when it's 5 minutes till, because I left it in my room. Would you do that, Phil?
Okay.
Let's go here and then to Bill.
Just along those lines, I found what you said very helpful about asking the question, whether it's charity, who am I most concerned about? And I think for me, that's a really helpful piece when I'm hearing these discussions about welfare and who gets what and tax. Because I think ultimately you can find the motivation when you ask, okay, who are we most concerned about here? And I don't want to say that people who are trying to change things don't care about the poor. I think you really have to be wise when you listen to the arguments and think, how much is this protecting people's investments and making more money at the top? And how much is truly trying to see that there's justice?
I want to hear from Bill and then see if we can take the conversation back to an earlier point, too.
I read a column in Time magazine a couple of weeks ago that really shook me. The author was saying, as he's sitting in his office writing, he sees a woman come in, empties his wastebasket, he goes and gets some coffee from the man down in the lobby, and wonders if they're wondering when he's going to rob them. He says, not with a gun, take their money. But when he goes on Social Security, he is robbing them. Because it's not coming out of what he has paid over the years, it's coming out of what will come out of their paycheck, and he doesn't really need it when he retires.
I want to, I'm sorry to have to ask you, what time do we have?
11:15.
So we're here till, we have 15 more minutes?
Yep. 30.
So we can agree to stay over a little bit.
Okay, okay. Well, someone had their hand up, kind.
I don't know where to start, but I'm just really, I feel very strongly. I think we all know that by, 2015, the Hispanic population in this country will be the largest population, and compared to blacks and Hispanics, the whites are going to be very small. And I just feel things have to happen now so that we can maintain a democracy. And we whites are the ones who have to change. We have to change our heart. We have to change how we think. We have to change what we do. And I think what Bill does at home, cities have to bring people together to decide how these changes are going to happen and what is fair to everybody.
I was listening to a tape I brought with me last night because I was wondering where to fit it in later this week. I'm not quite sure yet, but I had a chance to visit the King Center, and there's something about this. I've only been to Atlanta 3 times, and I've been to Atlanta 3 times in 14 months. And each time I've gone, I visited the King Center and feel more deeply and deeply touched by Dr. King's message in life. And I was listening to an audio tape of his letter from a Birmingham jail. And if you don't know the story, he was in Birmingham, even though his headquarters were in another community, Montgomery. He was in Birmingham, and the moderates of the church wrote him a letter while in jail admonishing him for coming to Birmingham and stirring up trouble. And he says several things in the letter which I find to be true of the church today. He said the first reason, first thing you need to know about me is that this ministry that started locally is now becoming a national ministry. So it's not just intended to stay in Montgomery, we're expanding. So that's the first argument. He said, but really, I'm in Birmingham because injustice is here. And a threat to justice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. I'm in Birmingham tonight and I'm in your jail because injustice is here. And it reminds me of the story when Henry David Thoreau, who inspired Gandhi, who inspired King, wrote about civil disobedience. King, there are two types of laws, and he's borrowing on St. Thomas Aquinas and Augustine, that there is just and unjust laws, and that we are morally, as well as legally, obligated to keep a just law, okay? Both obligated by law and by God to keep a just law. But even if the state says that we should live within an unjust law, we are morally obligated to break that law. King said that in Hitler's Germany, everything that Hitler did was legal. Why? Because he changed all the laws of the state to make it legal. But was it right? And was it good? And he says what he'd learned to be disappointed in the most was not the people in the South who hated him outright, but the moderate church who knew better and lacked the courage and did nothing and allowed evil to happen in their midst because they were afraid of speaking up for fear of losing something. And my sense is that's what time it is today, folks. We know on so many different fronts what's wrong with this country. We treat children horribly. One out of every four children lives in poverty in this country. Homeless women and children are living on the streets, most often because there are men at home who beat them up. There are people trapped in cycles of poverty. We know this. And the church has all of the necessary resources to fix them. Why are we afraid to confront Caesar?
I don't feel that I believe what you say, that the church has all the resources to change that. And I think that's my biggest obstacle.
Can I share a fact with you?
Yeah.
That 80% of the world's resources, according to Oxfam, are in the hands of Christians. The world's resources.
So not the church.
Well, it depends on what you think the church is.
I mean, the kind of B question I have is, you gave a suggestion about moving from service to, or from charity to healing by reflecting on what we do when we serve. Do you have any other ideas about how we change things? I mean, we've got 80% of the world.
Dr. King last night in the tape said that the word that he heard from the moderates most often was that, "Well, Dr. King, I really understand what you're saying, but you know, we're trying to deal with this issue and the church is here in Florida and it's really not the right time. It's really not the right time." He said the word he began to despise more than any other was wait. Wait. And he says those in power, those who are comfortable, unconsciously don't want change, but want to appear morally sensitive, so we argue, "I understand, but let's wait for a better time." And he talks about it in such powerful terms, you think that he's going to get nauseous. And I feel that way this morning, too. I feel nauseous. I feel absolutely frustrated with my inability over the years and the church's inability to activate the church and to have us work in a more prophetic way to bring justice. I think we keep waiting for another Dr. King. What would it mean to your question is that what will you do different this afternoon, not even tomorrow, what will you do different after lunch as a result of our time together? If the answer is nothing, then you're telling the oppressed to wait. If we do nothing, we're complicit. I mean, that's what's on my heart this morning. And my impression was Dr. King turning over in his grave because we've made him into a tame idol in this country who has a dream for how we will live together one day in peace. But if as long as it's a dream, it isn't going to cost anybody anything. We have perfectly contained him. We've captured him in the most innocuous container possible. And we put him on the shelf in American history and we point to him as an example of our commitment to justice. He must be rolling over in his grave.
One of the questions for reflection, you mentioned that idea of asking ourselves at the end of the day, as we work with in service to other people, what did we learn from them and what did they teach us? And I think for myself, that's kind of at the heart of what we need to be able to do. We actually need to believe that the people that we work with have things to teach us and not just in a token kind of way. And I think that's we can intellectually believe that, but I think because we've been brought up middle class and educated, we're brought up to really believe that we are better than. And I was talking this summer with Ingrid Christiansen, somebody we know her here at Holden, and she was telling about the work her husband Jody Kretzman does in Chicago, where his work is on asset-based development, where one of his projects is they took college students, went around in a poor neighborhood in Chicago, knocked door to door, asked people, what are the assets in your neighborhood? And from that found, you know, okay, there's a couple of stay-at-home moms who are excellent cooks, and oh, you know, the guy that you think of as a drunk down on the corner, he's actually an accomplished musician. And they really looked at each of the people that many of us would go in and see as only people with deficits, as people with assets, and turn it around. They also looked at not only the assets that the people had, what assets in the community, what other structural assets were there. Well, there was a school
that
wasn't being used from 3 o'clock until the next morning. And in that school now, they have, you know, that man who is the drunk is now teaching music lessons after school.
That's absolutely beautiful, Michelle. There's a book in the bookstore, actually, by John McKnight called Building Communities from the Inside Out, and it's to your earlier point. You know, we can see these people as only people in need, or we can see them with untapped gifts and capacities, that if we created new breakthroughs in our structures, if we began to look at systems, we could ask them to claim their civic responsibility and help out. I love Habitat for Humanity. You want a new house? Good. There's the nails. Here's some boards. We'll help. Linda.
This sparks a memory of a story that I loved. Mary Nelson works with this church in Chicago. I got the names gone. But they've worked in the neighborhood and tried to transform the neighborhood. She had one little story. She said there was a corner that was very bad for all the drug dealing that was going on there. And everybody knew that the drug dealers would be driving by and do their dealing right on this corner. So they talked about what the people in the neighborhood, could do. And what they decided to do was to sell lemonade. And they set up a lemonade stand.
I'd like to, and I really do believe that if you're interested in that form of empowerment thinking, McKnight's sort of got the corner on that industry. He's done some really powerful thinking, and we're using his stuff in Seattle. But let me just share with you something I've never really shared with a group before. The first part I have is, I may sound like I'm not, but I actually believe in the market economy. Because I also believe in the brokenness of human people, that I think it's the best we can hope for in ourselves, because there is greed and self-interest. And the market economy brings that into account. Me too, my greed, my self-interest. But the market economy, if left unbridled, you know, may or may not do the right thing. So what we need to do is to steer the market economy in its creative ability to create wealth and goodness, to steer the market economy towards our biggest needs. So this is what I'm hoping for, and I think that the church could help government do this, is that what if, the way the government does that, by the way, is creating tax disincentives. You know, if you want to make better and better CD players, you're not going to get tax breaks. If you want to make better and better overhead projectors, you know, the ones we have now work just fine. You're not going to get tax breaks. But we'll give you tax breaks if you become interested in these questions. How can we feed the world? How can we provide universal health care that is global? How can we make sure that everyone in the world has a home and is involved in some form of education that helps them to discover and utilize their gifts? And I forget what the fifth one is. But if we ask, as the church, and government, I believe, would follow, to direct the market economy towards those ends, could it be that we could set the entrepreneurs loose and figure out a cost-effective way to feed the world? Figure out a cost-effective way to fix the ozone hole. Figure out a cost-effective way to educate and house and provide health care for the world. I mean, it is a global marketplace, right? And we can't set by with two-thirds of the world going to bed hungry every night and think that the market economy is acting morally. How could we, as the church, re-steer the market economy? Bill? Oh, it's 5 minutes, okay. Anyone have any ideas about how we could do that? I see a wonderful smile in the front row.
Well, I don't know how to formulate this. What came to mind was the farm workers and Cesar Chavez and the boycott technique, which worked so well. And if we have this 80% of the world's wealth, I'm not sure you're right about that, but maybe, if Christians have 80% of the world's wealth, could Christians buy selectively or withhold their buying habits selectively enough so that we could put direct pressure on corporations? Or do we have to do this through government in some way?
Dr. King believes that those in power never, this is from a person who's been there, right? He said, never give power away of their own accord, either by economic pressure or by law. He said moral arguments were the lifeblood of the civil rights movement, but lawsuits were the backbone. You know? We got the consciousness of the people aroused, but until we sued the city of Montgomery, that's when people could ride buses again.
I wonder if perhaps one starting point might be in our, either as an individual or as a community of faith, to do much fasting and prayer, seeking a vision that is something that we believe in and moving forward on that in context of the issues that you are raising for us. Because I think this is not something that we're going to do on our own.
No.
And it is something that is going to, I just think by using the old traditions of fasting and prayer and coming together, that we could move forward on some of these issues. Part of our congregational problem is that we are so helter-skelter, so, well, there's a lot of reasons why we're not doing this, but I just wonder if that might be someplace, if not for everyone, maybe just ourselves as individuals.
I believe that is an essential way to start. If I don't start that way in the morning, I'm no good for anybody. Okay, but I believe that unless we also metaphorically sit at lunch counters, that nothing happens.
It seems to me, you know, if we could somehow create a market for virtue, we could harness a lot of the energies and the conventional ways of doing things in our economy towards some of these ends. Now, how do new things in business happen? Well, venture capital. How can we create some venture capital for projects all over this country so that ideas can begin to get tested?
Could you
if we could have, you know, turn this country into a national laboratory for addressing these social ills, it would be a great thing. And it seems to me what we need is at least are some institutional mechanisms to provide incentives. See, I'm not sure that the churches can provide the moral underpinning and direction, but I'm not sure that churches are where the organizational skills and gifts and the implementation gifts are. If we could turn a lot of these corporate CEOs and CPAs and engineers and economists who are well trained to solve a problem, give them the incentives to develop and implement ideas. So sort of things like tax incentives, special incentives to shelter, say,
corporate income, if corporations were to create philanthropies in their communities to address local problems, ways to incent, you know, wealthy people like Bill Gates to actually let loose some of this latent wealth to address some of these problems.
I
hopefully, maybe one way to go about it.
I really like what you're saying in a lot of ways. I want to come back and just address it briefly. Connie and Linda. And did you have your hand up? Was I missing you? I would like to come to you because you look very concerned and forlorn about something.
I don't know. It seems to me, you know, and the a lot of these ideas that sort of are retreading us, some old ideas that were tried in the late 60s and early 70s. And the example I can think of is energy efficiency. I'm probably younger than some of you people, but I remember there were incentives for exploring alternative energy sources like wind or solar or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it didn't work. I mean, we don't see much of that. It hasn't changed. We still use more oil than ever. And I don't know. I think people were talking about this. It just seems that it has to come back to the individual, that you have to decide what you believe about these issues, and then you can't look to a church or an institution. And the thing that I'm thinking of is that corporations respond like rabbits to whatever they perceive the public.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you see a little bit of an example of it in these investment, mutual funds that promise not to invest in various, say South Africa at the time, you know, when apartheid was strong, you know. I don't know if there can be some kind of grassroots, you know, that's what we're doing here, you know. But.
Well, you know, I think that the American church could learn a lot, you know, from the Church of El Salvador or the Church of Guatemala, where they absolutely do see the church as demobilizing source for community action, you know. And I would love for there to be, this is what I believe we could work towards that's practical, okay? I believe that we could work towards regional positions in the American Lutheran Church that we would fund and pay for out of our local churches, who would prepare us. We have legislative advocates, but they sort of go do our bidding. We would prepare, if we're a Christian church in a democracy, then blessed are we if we know what we're doing. So, you know, let's take the skills of democracy. We know it works. Can you imagine if once a month across this land, the ELCA said that in place of a sermon, what we'd like to do, each church will have to, we're going to ask you to invest to establish a set of phone banks. And here's email, and here's stamps and letters, here's snail mail. The sermon is, whatever you did for the least of these, you did to me. Okay, thank you, sermon's over, now go do something. And write a letter, and send an email, or make a phone call. And if the people in Washington, D.C. started getting thousands and thousands of messages Monday morning, week after week, month after month, the church could claim its rightful political place in this country. But the American church has become complicit, I'll be real frank now, with a selfish, unjust market economy. And the church, just like in the days of Solomon understood that if his reign as king was to be effective, that he would need to contain and tame the church into silence by allowing it to become fat and lazy. And that's the American church. If we were a patient, our cholesterol level would be so high, we would be frightened in exercise. We're not. And
could you say a little more about that? How is the church explicitly complicit? Are you saying that the people who control the budget of the ELCA are
on the payroll?
Are, yeah.
No.
I mean, what do you mean?
No, I'm not. that by our inaction, when good people do nothing, bad things continue to happen. By our inaction, by our tendency to write a document, and I don't have it with me, but we've just written another wonderful church statement on the economy. And church after church in 1998 will discuss that document and do nothing. And that goes all the way back to, let's talk about it, but do nothing. It alleviates our guilt, but nothing substantively changes. That is the two-step that the church and the market economy need to do. Here's what Robert Terry, in trying to understand institutional racism, we're going to be talking this on Friday, he began to look at the whole question of racism and how do we maintain institutional racism. He would help communities to understand institutional racism in their own towns by the first activity he'd have them do would be to create a clearly racist but believable community. And members of the city council and the mayor going, gee, you know, what do you mean? How do we do this? You know? And he wouldn't give them any instructions, and after about 5 minutes they were surprised on two counts. Number one, it was easier than they thought. And number two, the community they designed clearly represented their own community. And here's what they said the church should do to maintain racism. The church should write a powerful statement about inclusion. The church should openly invite people of color to join in their worship service. The church should have an occasional teaching on race and write clear mission statements about its commitment to racial justice, not like the Black Manifesto that Malcolm X wrote, not that harsh, but clear statements of inclusivity and occasional teachings on race so long as nothing changed. And if the church did that, it would be the perfect agent, you see, for racism to continue, because we all fall asleep going, boy, wasn't that a great sermon. Man, Martin Luther King Sunday was great this year, not as great as 1987, but I tell you, it was a good Sunday. Man, you know, we all go back and go, boy. You know, and did you see, we had two people of color visit us. Did you see that? Of course, they won't come back again, but boy, we had two people of color here today. Wasn't that great? And when the church does that, it is absolutely doing the tango with the status quo. And the status quo needs the church to play that role to appease our conscience. I'm sorry. Yeah, Connie? Linda was noticing your hand. Thank you for your help.
It wasn't up right now. I was taking it all in. Oh, no. If you have something to say, I my point is not good enough. Not relevant enough to
I have two things that I've been thinking about. One is someone said something about prayer. One thing I would like to see is individual congregations taking more ownership of call. We call our pastors and we pray for our pastors. Mm. Well, and we have prayer chains so that we have a mechanism for regularly praying for people who are ill. But I'd like to see a backup for people who, for instance, is a CEO, a member of the congregation, and ask, what is your call?
Great.
And then to have a group of people who are committed to praying for his call. Her call.
I think that's great.
Or whatever the position might be. That's one thing. Maybe I shouldn't do two things at once. The other is that energy. Something has been done about helping with energy. Because there is at least one organization that is that has set up a way of tapping into the self-interest of energy-producing businesses, something they call energy credits, so that if you pollute less, then you earn some credit somehow, and it benefits you financially. And this has been done. So it's a way of improving.
I want to hear from Connie, then I want to end with what I think is a note of hope. I hope you'll see it that way, and then we'll break.
Okay, I just want to say quickly something about this story. I work in a food pantry one day a week, and a woman came in with two sons, 2 and 5, and the 5-year-old could recite 7 verses from scripture by heart. And after my job is to complete a form which the client then takes to a window where they get food, and they can get food 4 times a year, every 3 months. And the story about this woman was she was homeless with these kids, and we have a new job center to teach people work skills, into literacy and what they need to be able to hold a job. And somehow she got in there, and she did very good work there, so they found her an apartment, but she had nothing to put in the apartment. One of the people who does the same job that I do works for St. Vincent de Paul, and they thought he could find furniture, and I said, well, I'll go to my church on Sunday and make an appeal. So I did that, and we not only furnished her apartment, but there were 5 Rwandan refugees who came in. We furnished them. And then somebody else came in from another country, and we took care of them. I'm not bragging on my church, but the gifts of the poor are all around. You just have to get to know poor, and you'll find them.
Let me end with what I think is a word of hope. And I've been entirely honest, so I'm not going to make it in any way Pollyanna-ish, but this is what I'm hopeful in eternally. I believe that the Holy Spirit is fully present, as the Holy Spirit has always been. And the Holy Spirit, I tend to see as a feminine presence. Cares deeply, moans deeply about the plight of the poor. And the Holy Spirit is busy revitalizing and, I believe, reinventing the church. I have no question in my mind but that the church will continue to work in inspiring ways on the creation of the kingdom. What I don't know, what I'm not sure of, is where the American church, what role the American church has left in the equation. You know, we may have had our opportunity, and we may have chose selfishness over good news. But what I am hopeful in is the Spirit is continuing to reinvent and continuing to renew the church. And what I'm trying to do is to watch for where and to join that effort. Peace.